Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Calvin Robinson. Now, Calvin is a British political commentator. He's a policy maker, campaigner. He's contributed regularly to papers such as the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail. And he's also frequently commentating for Talk Radio and GB News. Calvin, it's wonderful to welcome you to the Godcast. How are you today?
It's my pleasure to be here. I'm great, thanks. Happy Advent.
And to you as well. Yes, have you had a good Advent so far?
Penitential. I've tried to fast here and there. I started my Advent with a retreat, so it was quite prayerful and meditative, which is rather good. I'm not a Puritan in these things. I don't think we have to entirely cancel Christmas in the lead up to Christmas, so to speak. But I try to take it a slower pace and not overindulge.
Yes, I think that's good advice. I tried to do that, but like you say, it's not always that easy, is it, in the current climate that we're in? So where in the world are you today, Calvin, as we speak?
I'm in Oxford right now in my flat in Seminary.
Okay, and how's that going? I suppose everybody will know that you're an ordinand. How's it going for you?
I suppose they won't know. It's got its challenges. I love reading theology. I think it's a fascinating subject to study. And I'm in the last remaining sound seminary in the country, so I really appreciate being here. There are battles to be had within the institution itself. I'm sure we'll probably get into the church turning woke and all of those things, but yeah, it's up and down struggle.
your faith journey, is it something that's been encouraged by family? Were you raised in a Christian setting, or have you has it evolved for you as you've matured and become an adult?
No, it's definitely a later thing for me. So my family aren't entirely secular, but so my mother she's nominally Christian, and my father is a Baptist. So Christianity was around, but not as much as it could have been. I think my mother's mother went to church, but that was about it. My father's mother went to church as well. But, you know, I was taken to Sunday school every now and then. It wasn't a major part of my life. But what was a major part of my life was God. And I always had a relationship with God. I always prayed. I always felt like my prayers were answered. I always felt that comforting hand on my shoulder. I never felt alone, which was important to me. But I didn't really have a faith behind it. I didn't really understand what anything meant. So it was very much a journey. And I was always searching for meaning behind the experience. And it took me a long, long time to find Christianity. Well, not really to find Christianity, but to believe in Christianity, I suppose. I struggled with the idea of organized religion. We've seen so many instances of, because we are fallen and institutions are held up by fallen individuals, we've seen so many instances of wickedness within the institution. I struggled to believe in it, which is why eventually I came to the conclusion that I'm not believing in an institution. I'm believing in the truth as Christ told it. But at the same time, we have to have an element of compromise in that the institution is how we maintain that tradition.
Yeah. And what's your view on kind of politics and faith mixing? I haven't seen you bring your faith into debate. I don't watch every program you're on, but I haven't seen it personally. Do you think that these are two areas that I certainly feel in Westminster, it's very rare you see faith brought into a debate. What's your take on it? Do you think faith should enter the political arena?
I would say you have seen me bring my faith into it, because my faith is at the forefront of everything I do. When I'm fighting the cultural wars or whatever I'm doing, I'm trying to bring truth to the forefront. I'm trying to replace all of this wishy-washy nonsense of my truth with the truth. And I try to put my Christian values at the base of every argument that I make. So I'd say my faith is very much involved in it. And this idea that we could separate politics and faith, I don't really subscribe to. I think, our faith forms us, and it forms our politics. And the Christian faith is about as political as you can get.
Yeah. And I know it's a few years ago, but Tim Farron effectively gave up his role as leader of the Lib Dems because of his faith position. Do you think that was a wise choice, or do you think he made a mistake there?
I think he did what he felt was right, but I think it's a very sad state of affairs where a British leader of a political party feels they have to resign because they're a Christian in what is supposed to be a Christian country. That's very, very sad. I wish people would be more explicit with their faith, and I'm sorry to hear that you haven't seen me do that, and I'm not sure that's what you're referring to when you said it. I haven't seen me put my faith into an argument, but that's certainly what I'm trying to do at GB News, is be overtly Christian, because every time I am, I get messages from strangers saying thank you for being, you know, unashamedly Christian, because it gives people permission to do the same, and we need more of that in public life.
Yes, I'd certainly agree with you on that. Well, let's get down to some politics, and I'm sure the faith will intertwine with everything. As we're recording this, a week before Christmas Eve, and the Conservative Party have certainly had a bloody nose overnight in the North Shropshire by-election. I suppose the question is, there's two things in this. How important do you think integrity and honesty is, first of all? That's probably the first question to the British public.
Fundamental to everything we do. Honesty should be, you know, it should be a core principle of British people. I think it used to be. We used to be people that were considered honourable. You know, I try not to lie in general, even to the ones I love, not even white lies. And sometimes, you know, we have to say things very carefully not to intend to cause offence. But it's important that we speak the truth publicly, because the truth can be offensive in many ways, but the truth needs to be proclaimed.
And do you think that is why they've suffered such a bloody nose overnight, because of that? Or do you think it's more than that?
I think it's more than that. I think hypocrisy is something we cannot stand in this country. So that has the part to play in it. You know, telling people to do something and then on the other hand, doing the opposite yourself. That, you know, this one rule for them, another rule for us. That is horrible. But I think the reason that the Conservative Party in particular has suffered a bloody nose last night is because they've been overplaying their hand. The executive have been making decisions undemocratically and just thwarting the democratic process. They've been, you know, creating new legislation without parliamentary scrutiny, and that's abhorrent to a lot of people. There's the illegal immigration situation down in the Channel, which hasn't been resolved, and for years and years they've been blaming the EU. We left the EU a year ago, and the situation has still worsened. A lot of people are upset about that. That cannot be underestimated. And of course, there's just the whole, the immorality of the situation. In that we seem to have a new revelation every week or month that someone has committed something absurd within government or around them, and people are getting tired of it. And of course, there's all the whole situation about our civil liberties being taken away, and there's only so long people will allow that to go on. There's only, you know, so many times you can say, oh, just it's just a temporary measure, before people realize that it's not a temporary measure.
Yeah. And what's your feeling regarding Boris? Do you think he's on borrowed time, or do you think his party still want him as the leader?
Well, the party is quite fickle. So the party will want whoever is going to secure them votes. In regards to Boris, right now, he's on his last legs. Right now would be a good time to strike if any of them are planning to strike. And I'm sure there will be some, because they're very ambitious people. But he could bounce back. He's probably the only person, I think, that is capable of bouncing back from a situation like this. So if they leave it long enough, he will bounce back. So it's a case of what do they really want. But, you know, people of the British public have been saying for weeks now, if not months, that we are unhappy. I believe we've been saying that. And it's been falling on deaf ears. But now people have hit them where it hurts, which is in the ballot box on polling day. And that's really, truly all most politicians care about. So they will be listening now. They will be listening more than ever to lose such a safe seat. It's been a Tory seat since the early 1830s. You know, they've lost, 30,000 majority, a 30% dip. It's just crazy on every single level that the Tories have lost this. And it didn't go to the opposition. It didn't go to Labour, which means it wasn't a case that people have moved over. It was a protest. People have voted for the Lib Dems And this is a Brexit area, so it shows also that we've moved on from the Brexit conversation. But the Lib Dems are a party that are in favour of civil liberties, to some extent anyway, in that they are against vaccine passports, which I think are an evil. And this sends a message to the Conservatives, A, that we're against vaccine passports, and B, that we're sick of you playing with our civil liberties, and you need to listen to what the British public are saying.
Yeah, and do you think this is as much a failure for the Labour Party as it is for the Conservative Party? I mean, I have to be honest, I think the Liberal Dems, you know, they've kind of just been there in the background, you know, and few people know what they stand for, but somehow they've come through it, and Labour's vote is no stronger, it appears. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's quite amazing, actually. It shows how poorly Labour are performing, for them not to grab this when people are so sick and tired of the Conservatives. People might be sick and tired of Conservatives, but not tired enough to vote for Labour. The Labour Party are going to need a change of direction. They're going to need a new leader. They can't stick around with Sir Keir Starmer after he's pretty much agreed with everything the Prime Minister has done and said, and said actually just do it for harder or longer throughout the whole of this pandemic. They need someone who's going to hold the government to account. They need someone who's going to provide some opposition and lead the party in a direction that the British public want, which I believe is more patriotism and less wokeness. He's not the man for them, clearly.
And do you think they've solved their own internal squabbles? You know, the Corbyn versus the Starmer. I mean, the John McDonnell left still sat there waiting in the shadows to emerge again, or are they done and dusted now?
No, they're unelectable, and they will remain unelectable for at least another two general elections, I think. The squabbles are too big for them. There was a massive amount of entryism around Jeremy Corbyn's time. You know, this £1 to vote and all that kind of thing was terrible. The party was taken over by the hard left, essentially, and they've had to claw it back, but in a way that the middle ground or the centre-left have to appease the communists, and neither faction likes each other. They can't get on, they can't agree on anything. And the British public doesn't like that, I don't think. So they're not electable, but it's no good for anyone for them to be in that position, because I am a Conservative, and I know I'm talking down the Conservatives, or I have done for the start of this podcast so far. But the reason I do that is because I want them to be challenged. I want them to be good. And right now they're not doing good. They have an 80 strong majority. They could be helping this country reach great heights, and they haven't achieved anything that they set out to do other than tear us down. And it's so sad.
Yeah, and just trying to bring some kind of a bit more maybe faith aspect to politics, Calvin, it seems to me that Westminster just seems to be a place of vitriol. You know, it's kind of, it's almost like a boxing ring arena where it's just point scoring and punches landing. There seems to be a little room for empathy in British politics at the moment. Do you think that is a poor thing? And do you think it's something that needs to be redressed?
Yeah, I think it's because a lot of them don't believe in anything other than their own careers. Mm. We've got a massive gap in this country in terms of faith, and people are filling it in different ways. I think a lot of our politicians are very, very ambitious people, which is why they never speak up for their principles if they have them, which is so sad to see. And I think we've seen a similar thing in the British public in general, in that because we've lost our faith, we've reached out to different things to fill that void. We've got a massive God-shaped void, and people are filling it with Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion and all of these what I would call hard left ideologies, and they're very damaging to our social cohesion.
Yeah. I chatted to Geoffrey Archer on the Godcast not too long ago, and we talked about salaries for members of parliament, and he's kind of very firmly of the view, you know, if you want the best people, you've got to pay the best salaries, and a lot of people don't enter politics because whilst, 75, 80 grand a year might be a lot in East Lancashire, in central London, it's not necessarily, I think Geoffrey described it as not worth getting out of bed for. Do you think that is a serious conversation that needs to take place about salaries for MPs?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to, if we want the best people for the job, we have to give them the money for it. I'm not one who thinks that second jobs should be banned or anything like that. I think we need people with a foot in the real world. That's a great thing. I also think that if we want to entirely entice people away from industry, we have to pay them more. And I get when people say, well, 80 grand is a lot of money, of course it is in relative terms, but it's not if you want the best. It might be on an average level a lot of money, but if you want the best from every sector, it's not a lot at all. And that's surely what we want. And if we said, you know, a lot of people say, well, MPs shouldn't be paid at all, or take their money down, well, then what would we attract? What kind of person would we attract? We don't have the best politicians in the world at the moment, and we definitely need to raise the caliber.
Yeah. And just moving the conversation on a little bit, Calvin, I run a food bank in Burnley, and it's actually, I can say with my hand on my heart, it's never been as busy, and we're giving out more food than we have ever done. But actually, I don't think we're just feeding them physically now. I think we're feeding people in different ways, spiritually in some context, but mentally, because I think, as you alluded to, there's gaps in people's lives. But our society seems quite broken. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on food banks and the longevity of them. You know, frankly, I hate my food bank for the reasons that we have it.
Well, I think it's a fantastic thing, not just because you're able to feed people, but also that you're able to bring people together. And I think we've lost a sense of community in this country, a physical community at least, since, you know, the last couple of decades, really. I think the rise of the internet and the loss of community have gone hand in hand, because we're more connected to people around the world than we ever have been, but we're less connected to the people most physically near us, and those two things cannot be a coincidence. So while I don't think anyone should, I don't think it's a good idea, a good thing that food banks are needed, it's a good thing that they exist. But you mentioned that you're providing more than just food, like you're providing spiritual nourishment as well, and that's so important. Because the biggest thing for me over this last 18 months has been, or 21 months now rather, has the massive letdown of the church. Now more than ever, people have wanted something, or needed something rather, someone to look after their spiritual well-being. And it was the church's job to step in and say, we are here for you. Just imagine the amount of conversion that could have happened. People have already been exploring and looking and searching, and we weren't there. We closed our doors. And I think that is a wickedness that a lot of people will never forgive us for. And that upsets me to my core that we allowed that to take place. That the church decided to go above and beyond the government restrictions and closing our doors to the faithful. Even now, as things are open again, we've got churches dividing people. We've got medical apartheid, where big churches are saying you can only come in if you've got a certificate. It's like, how are you going to deny the sacraments to people based on their medical history? That is not Christian. That's the opposite of Christian.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think the church has done that? Do you think it's because, you know, I've recently become a member of General Synod, Calvin, you know, I've only done one sitting, but it's clear that the bureaucracy and red tape is almost suffocating and stifling, and it's clear to me that we're about to engage we're going to prioritize matters of sexuality above the poor. And I'm not saying that's wrong or right, but
it is wrong. You can say it's wrong.
Okay, say it's wrong.
We're putting identity politics above everything in the church right now, because we've become a secular institution that is obsessed with the secular arguments. We're obsessed with race, gender, and sexuality, and all of the issues that the hard left is pushing. We're not focused on the poor. We're not even focused on Jesus Christ anymore. That's how bad it's got. I'm much more likely to hear a sermon on climate change than I am on the resurrection or even the incarnation of our Lord and Savior. That is absurd to me. I know how we've reached that place, but what's worse than that, reaching that place, is the fact that many people don't even see that, as in people in the hierarchy. People in the pews do, and they're showing us that by walking out, but the people in the hierarchy are all for it.
That's really interesting and very, very thought-provoking. So, just trying to keep on the theme of food banks. What's your view on mental health, Calvin? Some people, I've had conversations, you know, alluding to this word woke, you know, where people have said to me, well, in my day, you just have to get on with it, you know. And I find that difficult to cope with, because I see the mental health struggles on a daily basis. So this, you know, I could relay endless stories and ones I feel are very genuine around particularly young people's mental health. Yeah. You know, what's your view in all that? You know, are people just a bit woke when they're saying they're not feeling very well mentally?
No, I think there's two sides to this. So I do definitely think there's an argument to be made that we should be more stoic. We need to be more resilient, but that is a skill that is learnt and a skill that is forgotten. We used to be a country that was all about the stiff upper lip, and now we're the country of the opposite of that, I think. But that's not people's fault. So if people are experiencing mental health issues, that's not their fault. It's just the way that we've been raised. And mental health is an obsession of ours at this point. So that, of course, there are people that go through really terrible things and really terrible traumas and need support and encouragement and prayer. But there are also people that are told that they are special, and that they are a special case, and everyone wants to feel special. And the more we give people things to identify as ADHD and this and that, and everyone has OCD and everyone has a reason or an excuse or for every single stress that they're going through or every single element in their life, rather than trying to work beyond it. And it's just another label. It's another identity quite often. I'm not saying that what people are experiencing isn't true and isn't happening and isn't horrible or doesn't need support. I'm saying we're not providing that support in the right way. We're encouraging people to look for problems, but then we're not providing the solutions to the problems. And I honestly think if people had a more rigorous prayer life, if we taught people how to pray and how to pray more regularly, a lot of the mental health issues we're seeing now would be lessened.
Yeah. So you clearly believe in the transformational aspect of faith. And what we are seeing, the early shoots of that at St Matthew's in Burnley, but it's a long process, isn't it? And I think there's something in there about actually our ability to nurture people. I think that's something else. I don't know if you agree, but I think we've lost the ability to nurture people along a journey. You know, I think this is not about me, but I'm just going to express this view. You know, I think we sometimes feel that in church that people are just going to walk in, understand the sacraments and become, you know, loving, law-abiding Christians, but I think it's much more complex than that. And I think there is certainly a nurturing role in our aspect as Christian leaders. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I would agree. I would probably call it formation, in that good catechesis would lead to good formation. And we don't have a lot of time for catechesis, and we certainly don't have a long time for pastoral relationships anymore in the modern world. And all of that is important. And it comes back to, you know, this is why we have a parochial system, isn't it? Because this is why we have the cure of souls, so that everyone is prayed for, but everyone has a home, everyone has a hub, a community centered around the parish church. But it doesn't, the modern world is just too disruptive. It doesn't work that way.
No. And in terms of the church, Calvin, again, I learned at Synod in November that, you know, the number of people attending church now is generally regarded less than 2%. Do you think that is kind of irreversible? Do you think we can stop this great tanker from turning, or is this about end of death, end of life care now? You know.
Well, I have to have a couple of thoughts on this. So I think Orthodoxy has always managed to survive. The church in general, the universal church, will always survive because it is ordained through Christ. So I'm not worried about that. But the institution of the Church of England, either that's at a fork. Either that will die, and if it continues the way it's going, it deserves to, or it will reform. And it is very possible that it could be reformed. All it needs is a change of direction. And I got in trouble recently for saying the church is lost. I do think the church is lost, but it's not lost permanently. Nothing is lost permanently, not in our faith. And I think that with a change of leadership, a big structural change, we could re-find our way. And, you know, as much as we joked about the Nestorian Death Star, you know, this idea of Jesus shaped Christ centered, or was it the other way around? That is what we need to be. We need to put Christ at the center of everything that we do and stop faffing around with secular issues and stop faffing around with wokeness and stop trying to catch up with societal norms. You know, the moral absolution of the church is important. The moment we continue trying to catch up to what's perceived to be acceptable today, there will always be a delay, will always be out of date, and it will always be irrelevant. That's not what the church is for, I don't think. We just need a reminder of that.
Yeah. Calvin, just a bit about yourself. Who are your kind of key role models as a young chap growing up? Just tell us a bit about it, because we see you on these shows, but we don't always hear the personal side of you. What's your kind of
role models? Is a good question. I'd say my mother, really. She's the most hardworking person I know, most loving, compassionate person I know. She embodies British values and Christian values without having to explicitly subscribe to them. And my grandparents. Well, I've got a very close family, actually. I think family is fundamental to our way of life. I think that's why the hard left try to go for the family first, to destroy the idea of family, so the state can step in and indoctrinate where they want. But from family, we have community. That's our first community. And then we have the parish, and then a wider community, and then the country. And I think without family, we forget all of those things. And we sometimes do. I don't think I have anyone in the public eye I could point to as a role model, because I've always been wary of looking up to people, because the moment, you know, it wasn't even the theology of idolatry. It's just the idea that, well, I suppose it was, but without knowing it, it's just the idea that everyone is so fallen that you can't set someone up to be your role model or your hero in that way, because they will let you down.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll rephrase the question then. In terms of political heavyweights, when I ask most conservatives, they kind of generally would point their eyes and gaze towards Margaret Thatcher. Do you have? Well, perhaps that needs even to ask the question. But so, key person for you politically.
Yeah. So Margaret Thatcher, Roger Scruton, the late Sir Roger Scruton. And if I'm talking about people who are around today, Douglas Murray helped me articulate my arguments a lot in the early days. There are a number of people fighting the good fight. But yeah, I think Margaret Thatcher is a key one because she's so often misunderstood. I think she was a good Christian woman who had, she was a small C conservative who believed in the family, believed in the community, and wanted to improve social mobility in this country. But people paint her as almost like a neoliberal. They only see her economic stance and they ignore what she was trying to do. I think that's at their loss.
And regarding your career, you know, as an ordinand who will be ordained, when will you be ordained?
In June, God willing.
In June. And is this, you know, what I find very inspiring about ordination is that is responding to a call from God to ordain ministry. I suppose the question I have for you is, do you see ordained ministry as the long-term kind of job description, or do you plan to, remain a face in media and be a voice, or will there be a period where you disappear to kind of serve a curacy and, you know, and such like? What's your thoughts about your longer term future?
For the long term, I have no idea. I just try to look out for the doors that God opens in front of me and walk through them. But for the short term, I do have to have I do have to step forward. So I think what I'm trying to do is discern what my calling is, and I am called to ordained ministry, but I'm also called to proclaim the truth publicly, to public ministry. And for me, that is apparently in the form of broadcasts and or written word. So I don't see them as separate. I do very much see what I do in the media as part of my calling, just as my time in education is very much part of a formational part of my vocation.
Yeah. And in terms of GB News, it had quite an awkward start, you know, with different things. It seems to be settling down quite nicely, and audience figures seem to be increasing. Are you personally pleased how GB News is progressing?
I'm absolutely chuffed, because it's something that I am its audience, so I can totally relate. I've been looking for something like this for a long time. The BBC and mainstream media in general has gone entirely woke. It's not left-wing in particular, but it's certainly not right wing. It's got its own metropolitan liberal elite stance that looks down its nose at people like me and sneers at us. It doesn't talk to us or with us. So I was looking for something with a different perspective, and I think that's what GB News is. It offers balance. It offers everybody a voice, open debate and conversation without looking down their noses at people. And that's fantastic. And I think we need more of that.
And what's its target audience, Calvin? Is it kind of just people who aren't woke, or is it trying to attract the working classes of Lancashire mill towns? What is it? Everybody, would you say? Yeah,
that's the same thing there. I think its target audience is the general British public. I think there is a core demographic of woke people within, you know, within the inner cities, and especially within Westminster and surrounding area of London. They love the BBC, but I think the rest of the country is getting to a point where we're sick and tired of it. We're sick and tired of not just being so mainstream media as a whole, but the BBC epitomizes it in particular because it's supposed to inform and educate, and it doesn't do that anymore. It lectures. I think every single piece of media they put out is telling us that we're bad people, we're living bad lives, but not in a Christian sense. It's in a sense of we are not woke enough, we're not subscribing to the right moral code, and that moral code is the woke code. And I think people are sick and tired of having that shoved down their throats. So I think the general British public is small C conservative, cares about the family, cares about British values, wouldn't necessarily be able to articulate them because they are intangible, but knows what they are when they see them, and knows when someone is offending them. And I think mainstream media is offensive to British values at the moment.
Yeah, and Calvin, just with your Christian, your Ordinand head on, you know, I sense quite a lot of anxiety in the air, you know, with whether it is the fallout of Brexit, or whether it is the pandemic, or whether it's just the period of uncertainty. But what would you know, we are very close to Christmas, and I think, you know, I've been trying to encourage my congregation there is great hope to be had in our faith. What would your words of encouragement be to people who will watch this in terms of Christian faith and the future as well on the other side of Christmas?
Well, I think Christianity is, well, Christ rather, is the light shining in the dark. And right now, I don't think we've ever been, not in my living memory, anyway, we haven't been in such a dark place before. So the light is needed now more than ever. And for all the people that are feeling lost and feeling isolated and feeling vulnerable and feeling that they don't even recognize this country anymore, or feeling that they don't know what normality is anymore with all these constant changes, that the answer is there, and the answer is reaching out to them, just waiting for them to find it and reach back. I'm not the kind of guy that, I know I'm training for ordination, but I'm not the kind of guy that preaches. I try to rather live my life as an example. I think that's what we're all called to do. I think as much as people are sick and tired of being told they're a racist because they're white, or that they a person can identify as a woman and go into women's changing rooms, or that there are 99 genders, or people are sick and tired of being told things that they can see are clearly untrue, clearly don't pass the common sense test, and that their reality is no longer the true reality, and that there is now a perceived reality that is the true reality. As much as people are sick and tired of that, they're looking for an alternative, a positive alternative, and that's what the faith is, that's what Christianity is. It's shining as a light. It is a positive alternative. It's countercultural to all the madness that's going on around us.
Okay, thank you, Calvin. Thank you. And in terms of us being up in Lancashire, is the north of England a place you're familiar with? Have you darkened the doors of Burnley at any time, or Lancashire?
Well, I'm from the Midlands. So I've spent a lot of time in the middle of the country, but I spent a month up in County Durham recently for a placement in Hawarden, which I don't think you can get much further north than that, really. So yeah, I've been around. I used to holiday in Skegness as a child.
Yeah. How did you find the northeast, Calvin? I went up there on a summer school, actually, and I found it, very northern and not too dissimilar to where I was from. But it's a earthy, wonderful place, isn't it, the northeast? Did you enjoy your time there?
I love the north in general. I just think the further north you go, the further away from London you go, the more normal things seem. And, you know, I'm in Oxford at the moment, but I spend a lot of time between Oxford and London for ministry and work and stuff. But when I get to escape, I'm reminded that actually the country is in a better shape than the media would have it portrayed, and people are carrying on with their normal lives in the way they always have done. There is a very much a bubble down south, but we need to poke ourselves out of every now and then to remind ourselves of that.
Yeah. And when you're not studying or making political comment, what kind of other interests do you enjoy?
I'm always studying or making political My life here is very intense. There's a lot of studying to be done. And the moments I get any downtime, my relaxation is political commentary. It is how I release.
Yeah.
It's my comfort zone. I don't have much time to watch television or anything like that. I haven't read a fictional book in a long time. Someone's just sent me this. Evelyn Waugh's.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. Henry. Wonderful.
Which is obviously very, relevant for where I'm studying at the moment. And I love that period. So I'm going to make an effort to read that over Christmas, because I'm reading so much theology and so much nonfiction that I haven't had a time to unwind and really soak up some fiction. So that'll be good. But I used to play video games. I used to love playing video games, but I just don't have the time anymore.
No. And are you working in the media over Christmas, Calvin, or have you got a bit of time off?
Both. So I'm going to be doing a Christmas special on GB News, which will be explicitly Christian, wholesome, not political, something that no other channel would dare do these days, something the BBC would have done years ago. I'm so looking forward to that. And I'll be on a few panels making appearances in the run-up to Christmas. But over Christmas, I'm not doing anything, because that's Christmas. So from Christmas Day until New Year, I'll be taking a break. I'm going up to Edinburgh and just escaping.
And are you engaging in midnight mass? Have you down for some readings or sermons?
Yeah, I'll be serving and reading and all of that in my sending parish, as I do every year. I love it. Christmas mass is great. I don't live that close to my sending parish anymore, so on Christmas Day morning I'll go to the local parish church. But up until then, I'll be in my sending parish.
Fabulous. Well, Calvin, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I've found it extremely interesting. And from Lancashire, Burnley, we wish you a blessed Christmas. Keep up the good work. Keep taking the faith to the nation. As you said, it's very much needed at this time. Calvin, thank you.
Thank you. God bless.